Welcome to another episode of Naval History and Heritage Commands, Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. I'm your host, Cliff Davis. Today's show revolves around historical artifacts in the NHHC collection that are part of Operation Neptune, the naval component of Operation Overlord, more formally known as D-Day. For those of you unfamiliar with Operation Neptune or D-Day, here's a simplified version. In the early hours of June 6, 1944, an Allied invasion fleet, consisting of thousands of warships, landing craft, and merchant vessels, delivered five naval assault divisions of almost 133,000 troops to the beaches codenamed Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword. The U.S. Navy's forces included 284 warships, including five battleships, 23 cruisers, and scores of destroyers, destroyer escorts, and landing craft. Dropped behind enemy lines to secure the Allied landing zones and push inland, paratroopers of the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions helped distract German forces and contributed to the success of Utah Beach landings. The British and Canadian landing forces faced less resistance on Gold, Juno, and Sword. Still, some of the most intense fighting happened at Omaha Beach. At critical moments in the battle, several destroyers steamed as close to shore as possible to fire point-blank on German positions. Their bravery allowed the pinned-down GIs to move forward, engage, and destroy the enemy. The combined casualties from the Allied countries during the landings numbered 10,300 personnel. Now joining me in the studio today to discuss a few D-Day artifacts within the NHHC collection are Dave Manning, Small Arms and Ordnance Curator of the NHHC Curation Branch, and Jenny Ashton, Museum Specialist, also from the Curation Branch. Thanks for joining me. Would you mind giving our listeners a little bit about your background and how you became a curator for the Navy?
Sure, Cliff. I started off volunteering at an Army museum because my dad was in the Army and the Reserve, so I had an interest in it back in high school. And then I got a degree from the University of Maryland Military History, and I actually ended up doing an internship here at the Navy Museum when I was in college. And then I worked for the U.S. Army Center of Military History for about 10 years. I worked at the Fort Meade Museum in the Army Museum System for another 7 years. And then the museum there at Fort Meade was closing, and I was looking for other job opportunities. And I had already had an association with Naval History and Heritage Command. So when the job became available, I was really interested in it. And fortunately, they hired me, and I've been working here since 2016.
I have a bachelor's degree in history and a master's degree in museum studies, so I'm really approaching this from the museum side, whereas, you know, Dave has a lot of experience, you know, as a military historian and military curator. I'm approaching this as, you know, a museum professional, and I'm coming up on 9 years working specifically for NHHC.
For the first item that we'll talk about, it's a map used by the gunnery officer of the USS Texas for its firing plan during the D-Day invasion. What specific information is listed on it that would identify the support that Texas gave during the landings?
Well, the map here has several hand-drawn annotations that show what lanes had been cleared by minesweepers so that the ship could approach the coast, you know, safely, avoiding mines. But along the coast and a little further inland, there are markings annotated with a T followed by a number to illustrate what their firing priorities were. And T1 is actually at Point du Hoc, which there was a German artillery position there that, because Point du Hoc is a small promontory between Utah and Omaha beaches, from that position, the Germans had fairly good coverage over both of the American approaches on both Utah and Omaha Beach. So the priority for Texas and several of the other ships that were part of the task force was to eliminate the artillery position to help protect the Americans and allies coming ashore.
Are there a lot of T's, I guess, on there in priority? Did they say T1 from 1-100?
I was doing a quick check, and the highest number I found, I believe, was T176, but I will also admit I could not find T2 through T20, so I don't know if they weren't on here or
possibly another part of a map or another map.
It could be, yeah.
Were there other handwritten details on there from the gunnery officer that was using it, or by chance another officer or sailor?
There are markings on here that show where the ship was anchoring. It's where she would stop to provide fire support, observe what was going on, or await new assignments. So the earliest one for D-Day actually marks at 0130. To show her position, and that's when it's first entering the area that's covered by this map. approaching through those cleared lanes. And there are also a few anchorage markings closer into shore, and then there are a few that are dated for June 9th and 10th to show that, obviously, she remained in the area following the initial invasion to continue to provide fire support.
So what can we learn about the strategic planning and execution of the DD landings from this map?
Well, it shows that it was, you know, obviously well planned. They had channels cleared just prior to the fleet advancing so that they could, you know, hopefully approach the shore as safely as possible. And it shows that they had identified hundreds of potential enemy emplacements along the shore that they wanted to target to protect the soldiers as they came ashore. Unfortunately, I think the Texas began firing shortly before 6 a.m., ceased firing shortly before 6:30 in the morning, and I think the first soldiers started to land about 6:40. Unfortunately, the landing did not go as planned. The naval force comprising of the Texas and destroyers and the other Allied ships, the whole idea was that they were supposed to help soften the defenses. Well, unfortunately, the large guns didn't really do a lot of damage because they were firing, you know, further inland, whereas these emplacements were closer on the shore, so they weren't exactly hitting in the right spots. The invasion did not go exactly as planned. The ships remained a few miles offshore until closer to noon when, obviously, the officers on the naval ships realized that something is definitely going wrong on the beach. The soldiers are still pinned down by German machine gun emplacements and mortar attacks. So the Texas and other destroyers in the area started kind of on their own providing what support they could. So they started, you know, firing into the cliffs. The destroyers are also well known for approaching incredibly close to the beach, to the point of almost touching bottom, or in some cases they may have actually hit bottom, so they could bring their 5-inch guns in as close as possible. And there's one account that said some of the destroyers were in close enough that they were actually receiving rifle bullets from the Germans. But those smaller, like the 5-inch guns, were able to hit those machine gun emplacements, and just the act of them firing helped to pin the Germans down, which gave the soldiers on the beach an opportunity to begin to exit.
Another item that your office has curated on the NHHC website is a 5-inch cartridge case from the USS Frankfurt, DD-497. After reading some of the ship's war history reports on the National Archives or NARA website, the report talks about how the ship almost went aground, firing into the hills like you mentioned, and was literally looking at a tank for direction. It reads that the tank commander was popping his head out and directing his ship to fire by signaling. So with this item, Dave, do you mind describing what it is and how it was used?
Sure. It's actually just the base from a 5-inch 38 cartridge case. It was cut down and probably used as an ashtray, which was kind of a common thing to do. 5-inch 38 cases are actually pretty big to begin with. And this was probably taken as a souvenir by somebody and turned into an ashtray. But it definitely represents what the destroyers were doing on D-Day. And as Jenny said before, though, the naval ships started off with indirect fire bombardment that largely fell behind the beaches. And then they realized that all of the landing forces were still pinned down on the beach and they needed more direct fire support. So these destroyers came in very close to shore and they were firing directly into the German positions. And because the communications had broken down between the beach and the fleet, the troops on the shore were using other methods to try and signal them to indicate where targets were. And a lot of times they simply did just start shooting at a target and the ships offshore figured it out. And then they started concentrating their fire on those same targets. And in a lot of cases, the destroyers operated independently, and they realized from their vantage point that a lot of the targets, a lot of the gun positions that were causing the troops on the shore from they were keeping the troops on the shore from being able to advance inland, they couldn't target themselves. So the destroyers would independently start shooting at these different positions that they identified from offshore.
Now, would the destroyer have had a map similar to the one that the USS Texas used?
Yeah, all the ships would have had firing plans. As Jenny talked about earlier, this was very well planned out and very well coordinated initially, so everybody had their own specific set of targets and firing lanes and and areas of the beach that they were supposed to focus on. But as is common, first contact with the enemy, all the plans go out the window, so they have to adapt to the existing situation. So a lot of that stuff changed. And also with Omaha Beach, because of the massive confusion of the forces landing on the beach, a lot of the landing forces ended up in the wrong parts of the beach too. So there was a lot of adaptation that had to happen in order for the landing to actually succeed in the moment.
And the ships, their primary job that day, they were already done with that. And that was, you know, the initial naval bombardment to soften up the defenses. So they weren't really supposed to be taking part in any other major operation at that point. They were supposed to be acting as screening. But because everything was going sideways, that's when the fleet began to act independently to, you know, just provide whatever support they could, and rather enthusiastically.
And like in the case of the Texas, their direct gunfire on Pointe du Hoc actually directly aided the Rangers, because they were able to knock down part of the cliff face and give the Rangers a easier access to climb up. They cut a big swath in the front of the cliff face, and that debris came down and piled up on the beach. It aided the Rangers in their ascent of the cliff.
Another one of the items that I found particularly interesting that your office has curated is the national ensign for LCIL 488, or Landing Craft Infantry Large 488. Doing the background research on that ship, also on the NARA website, the war reports described how the ship was based in Weymouth Harbor in England, attached to the 12th Fleet and 10th Flotilla, and detailed all their operations through May, which here's where they get their crew, assigned an army staff, and start participating in this operation called Fabius, where they're conducting cruising, beaching, and general quarters exercises in Weymouth, which is quite literally dry runs for the D-Day operation. And another war report, it details how they got right up on the beach, offloaded their 194 enlisted personnel and 8 officers onto the beach, and then backed off. But this is one of many instances flown during D-Day. Does NHHC have any other flags from other ships that also participated in the operation?
Yes, there are other flags from ships that participated in the D-Day landings in the collection.
In the photograph of the ensign, based on the damage shown, what can curators and historians infer about the intensity of the fire that the ship faced during the landings?
Well, you can tell by looking at the photos of the ensign that there was quite a bit of action going on. A large portion of the flag is missing. It's smoke-stained. There's a large hole through the middle of it just below the field. So it is kind of evocative of the action that was going on and the violence of it.
The other flags in the collection that are also from ships that participated in D-Day also show the same degree of damage.
So how do these flags serve as a tangible reminder of the experiences of the crew and the soldiers and sailors who participated at Omaha and Utah Beach and in D-Day itself?
Well, as you probably know, you know, a ship's ensign, it's the national flag of the United States. So it's a definite patriotic symbol of what they're fighting for. But it also identifies them to that particular ship. You know, every one of them is the same, but they're all specific to the ship. So it's a really core piece of identity for that ship. It really represents the ship and its service. And I think in this case, you know, a lot of people don't think as much about the Navy and ground combat, but in this case, these ships were actually going up on the beach and sitting there and being shot at by German forces from the shore. And there was really a tremendous amount of volume of fire that was directed at them. So these sailors were really directly involved in the invasion and really, in a lot of cases, suffered for it. And that's shown by the condition of the flags. I think that really does represent what those sailors did very, very well.
And unfortunately, D-Day is really seen as like an army action, because obviously they were the ones making the landings. But obviously, that landing would never have happened without the Allied navies being involved. There's no way they were getting across that channel. So even though the Navy component is sometimes overlooked or not talked about as much, it's still a very important part of the whole operation.
Right. Couldn't have happened without the Navy.
It's the largest amphibious assault ever.
Yep, and that's all because of naval forces. And again, I think people think of, you know, the Navy as being at sea and aircraft carriers and battleships and all that kind of stuff. And in this case, they were in you know, direct combat with German ground forces.
And several Army officers that were on the beach even said that the invasion could not have succeeded without you know, the destroyers and the battleships providing that extra support that they weren't even planning on doing, because without them, you know, helping to suppress the German fire, the Army would have never been able to make that breakthrough off of the beach.
Of course, then there's all the Navy personnel and Coast Guard personnel too that are manning all of those landing craft that are bringing the troops in, and then there are also Navy personnel that are going in and landing on the beach as well.
In talking before recording this podcast, Dave, you had mentioned that NHHC has a unique collection of a sailor who was actually at D-Day, a Lieutenant J.G. Mortimer Kaplan. Would you mind giving a little bit about his background and what we have of his and its importance?
Sure, Cliff. Kaplan was had a very interesting career and a very interesting life. He actually lived to 103, too. But he started off as a lawyer, and he volunteered for a commission in the Navy. And initially, he was assigned as a special agent doing investigative work for the Office of Naval Intelligence out of the 5th Naval District in Norfolk in 1942. And then in 1943, he wanted to get, I guess, into the action, so to speak, and he applied for a ship assignment. And he ended up in the amphibious forces, and he was assigned to the 7th Naval Beach Battalion. And the 7th Naval Beach Battalion comprised a variety of different elements that was intended to provide a bridge between the Navy offshore and Army forces going inland. And he commanded a platoon within the battalion. He was a beach master. And within the platoon, they had four different sections. There was a medical section to provide medical support, a hydrographic section that was intended to mark lanes to allow landing craft to come in, move in and off, back and forth off the shore. They had communications to do ship-to-shore communications. And then there was also a small boat repair section for making repairs to the landing craft. And the 7th Naval Beach Battalion for the invasion was assigned to the Army's 6th Engineer Special Brigade, which was a combination of various engineer forces. And all of these forces worked together to provide a pathway to allow the assault forces to actually land on the beach. So one of their initial things they were supposed to do was clear mine lanes and get rid of obstacles and demolition and that sort of stuff to allow the landing craft to come in. Now, Kaplan's unit ended up not going in on June 6th because there was too much confusion and they just simply couldn't be brought in. So they ended up coming in the next day, the morning of the 7th. And one of the first things that Kaplan had to deal with were the high number of dead and wounded that were still scattered all over the beach. So that was one of the first things he had to deal with. It was getting an Army Graves Registration Unit to come in and help clear the casualties off the beach, because they, of course, couldn't move material, men and material and supplies back and forth across the beach with all of these bodies all over the place. So we had to move those out of the way. They stayed on the beach for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then Kaplan's unit went back to England afterwards. And then through a friend of his, he was actually pulled out of the 7th Beach Battalion and assigned to the headquarters as a legal officer, because he was a lawyer by profession, and he ended up spending the rest of the war as a legal officer. So he had a rather interesting career highlighted by this one seminal event of landing on Omaha Beach for D-Day. Kaplan later went on. He taught law for quite a while. And then he was appointed to be the director of the Internal Revenue Service by President Kennedy. And he continued on with that into the Johnson administration as well. He left government service in 1964, and he went into the legal profession and established a legal firm here in Washington, D.C.
Okay, so what items do we have of his?
Well, we have a number of different things that were material that he had saved from his service. We have a pair of Army winter combat trousers. We have his assault gas mask, which was a special mask that was issued for the invasion. And we have some other miscellaneous things, too. We have his cleaning tools from his weapons, a couple of flashlights. But the most significant thing we have is his helmet. A standard Army-designed M1 helmet, but it has all of the unique markings that were put on it specific to the invasion. One of the issues that they encountered with creating these special units that were supposed to stay on the beach was keeping them on the beach. And in a situation like that, where you need as many personnel as you possibly can to fight against the enemy, oftentimes some of these more specialist troops that had a specific job to do would be redirected by the commanders on the scene as infantry. So they needed a way to identify these guys, so they put a lot of special markings on them. The Navy personnel, they had a gray band around the rim of the helmet. There was a red arc on the front of the helmet, and they actually stenciled USN on them as well to try and identify these guys as, no, they're supposed to stay on the beach. They have a job to do on the beach, and they can't be redirected off to do something else.
That's interesting. Now, with all these objects, why is it important that we preserve items like these for future generations?
Well, I think the primary reason is because this represents the service of the individuals, either like Kaplan's helmet. That was the helmet he actually wore. In case of some of the other objects, you know, they represent the ships that these sailors served on and fought on. I think that's the most important thing out of this, is that we're preserving the history of people who served in the Navy and defended the country through these objects.
So if a listener has an item or items like Lieutenant J.G. Kaplan's, where would they go to find out more information on how to possibly donate it to NHHC?
They can go to our website, our command website, and there's information on there about how to contact us, and it has all the information listed that we need so that we can consider objects for donation.
Like, what kind of information would a curator be looking for?
A description of the object, what is its story, you know, where did it come from, who owned this or who had this, who used it, and definitely photos, so that we can, you know, we take all that information and see, you know, does it fit with our collection, or would it be better placed with one of either one of our other Navy museums or with another military museum.
Do either of you have any final thoughts for their listeners today about D-Day and about these items?
There's probably other stuff that we could say, it came from this ship and this ship was there, but we don't necessarily know if this thing was there. We have a lot of that kind of stuff.
Like, we have a lot of builder's plaques from ships that were ships and vessels that were involved in the operation, but
right, like
obviously they would have been or most likely would have been present, but those objects don't speak to the action itself.
Yeah, we have the builder's plaque in UA from USS Emmons. That was one of the destroyers, and that was at Omaha Beach. So yes, the builder's plaque was on the ship when it was there at Omaha Beach, but it's not exactly the same thing as, you know, as say the ensign or, you know, some of the other objects that are more directly connected with the invasion.
Now, how do all these objects combine to tell a bigger story about the D-Day landings?
Well, they definitely tell the story of the Navy's role in the Normandy invasion, which was tremendous. Again, it couldn't have happened without the Navy, largest amphibious invasion in history. The Navy does amphibious. The Army provided all the ground forces, but they couldn't get there without the Navy. So I think that's probably the most significant thing about this. And, you know, this time of year, I think the Navy primarily focuses on Midway, which was obviously the turning point of the Pacific War, so it's a significant battle. But I think it somehow gets lost in the shuffle that the Normandy invasion also happened in June, and that also is a tremendous accomplishment for the Navy. I would say one thing to communicate to sailors who are serving now, what you're doing now is equivalent to what was done in World War II. And what you're doing now is just as important, and your objects, the things that represent your service, are just as important as all of the objects that we've been talking about now. And for the most part, the only reason that a lot of the stuff we have now in the collection survived was happenstance. Somebody put it in a closet somewhere and forgot about it. So what we really need to do is make a concerted effort to preserve the Navy history as it's happening.
Thank you for your time today and coming in to talk about these D-Day items. I have found doing the research on these really interesting to learn more about the items themselves and then how they tied together to give a bigger picture for sailors and that and largest amphibious assault that they did.
Sure. You're welcome.
Learn more about these items discussed today by visiting history.navy.mil and enter into the search bar D-Day artifacts. To obtain more information about the planning and execution, combat art, imagery, and perspectives from both Allied and Axis forces, search out Operation Overlord within the NHHC website. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of Artifacts of D-Day on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.